Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Being a reporter and assigned to covering the White House is considered one of the greatest assignments in a journalist's career. You can't get much closer to the center of American power than that. Americans and the people around the world are depending on you for the news coverage on the most powerful man in the free world. But then you get the job and you realize there's a lot of sitting around and waiting for press briefings or surprise press conferences. And then there are times when news is breaking fast and furious. You have to be ready with your A game. Stephen L. Herman was there in the press pool during the Trump years and for some of Biden's time in the White House. He is the chief national correspondent for Voice of America, and he's written the new book, Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist's story of covering the president and why it matters. And Steve Herman, welcome to The Source.
David, it's a pleasure to be on the air with you.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the fact that you wrote this book because we're all concerned about the erosion of trust between people and journalists and reporting and news outlets. And you write a lot about, I think it really kind of helps people understand like what the job is and what you try to do and do it well and what that might look like, but also how in today's era when there's so much of these wild conspiracies that fly around. And there's a little bit in the book, I just want to highlight this, just kind of show what you dealt with. So emerging from the Oval Office on March 17th, 2021, President Biden briefly stopped to answer questions on the South Lawn before boarding Marine One. The president, wearing a black mask, gestured with his hands close to a group of microphones, which can be seen in the TV pool video. Biden leans forward as he's replying to a question, saying, "Not at the minute," and he emphasizes a point with his right hand, which appears to go through a microphone, which is a large, gray, furry cover that is attached to a boom pole. So what happens next?
Yeah, that was my microphone that his hand supposedly magically was going through. And within a very short period of time, video started popping up online on social media sites, especially Twitter, that actually the president had not been on the South Lawn of the White House, that this had all been staged. It was, you know, in the broadcasting business, we call it a green screen, like what the weather forecaster on TV has behind them. In other words, saying that the president, or his double, as some of the conspiracy theorists claimed, that this was all staged and that the reporters, including myself, were part of this elaborate hoax.
They're saying that Biden, that was not really Biden, or Biden had already died, and that there was this vast conspiracy and they were using CGI. And you were there. And you said, no, I was there. That was my poll. It was just one of those things.
Right. It's sort of, I mean, it's the ultimate gaslighting, right? You're the one who was actually there and having to defend reality. It was one of the most surreal things that I've come across on social media, and I've seen a lot over the years. And so I got on social media pretty quickly, Twitter, to say, no, I was there and this is real. And I guess that was a bit of a low point in what you were talking about in the introduction about this mistrust, but for people to actually believe that, that the moon landing was faked or something like that, and it's a lot different. You know, you can see these things online and laugh about it, but then to actually have been at a real event and you know, holding the supposed microphone that that the president's hand went through, because it wasn't a real president, to get on social media and have to defend reality was one of the more stranger things that I've had to do as a White House correspondent.
Right. So what it brings to my mind is that Stephen L. Herman, mean, you're a regular guy. I can see you take a real sort of a blue collar approach to journalism. You go out there and you do the work. You're not the product of some, you know, genetically modified product. You know, you came up through working in small radio and work your way up until you got to this plum assignment. When people get to know that who you are, then I think that should mean something, that they develop a relationship with you as a journalist and as someone who can be trusted. There's a lot of talk these days about AI. I want to talk more about HI, human mm-hmm. intelligence. And when we know the people behind the news, that's where, you know, the veracity comes from, I think.
Well, I think it's perhaps 99% of the people that I've interacted with or have read my social media posts over the years, which is how I mostly interact with people in the United States, because Voice of America, we should stress, is an external broadcasting service of the U.S. government. We do not target or broadcast to the United States. We have 48 language services, and that's my role, is to explain what's going on in America to the rest of the world. And I have been a very straight shooter in both my reports and my social media postings for 20 years or so, but there's that 0.1% out there, and whether they are the type of posters that are just trying to get attention and don't really believe what they're posting, or they actually believe that there's this vast conspiracy and our former president said that media is the enemy of the people, or they're actors on behalf of a foreign country. We know that the Russians are trying to not necessarily determine the outcome of a presidential election, but just to sow distrust in the process to weaken the United States is a method of asymmetrical warfare. And so inserting themselves into these conspiracy theories is one way to do that, and to also further erode trust in the media.
Yeah, we're going to get into, when we come back from this break that's coming up here in just a minute, about the Voice of America and how it is being an objective news source. It's written into the law that created Voice of America, and what you do, who receives right. that news, and who you're thinking about when you are in the White House covering these events. But also, you know, I know in the book you wrote about how reluctant you were to even get on Twitter initially. And there you had to go to just defend reality.
Exactly. To me, originally, these social media platforms were sort of the modern day replacement of the police scanner, where you would monitor stuff, eyewitnesses on the scene or authorities. But it quickly evolved, and I was initially uncomfortable with that, into much more of a two-way dialogue.
Right, and you also read about how when Elon Musk took over Twitter, how you felt that was not a good move for the true information being spread about. We're going to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. Text us at the call-in number, 833-877-8255. If you got a question for Steve Herman about covering Donald Trump in the White House, his years in the press pool, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with Stephen L. Herman. He is a senior correspondent for Voice of America. He has a new book, Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist story of covering the president and why it matters. So let's go over Voice of America. This is an external news source goes around the world, I guess like Radio Free Europe, and educate people about what's happening in the United States and democracy. I remember when I lived abroad, I had my little shortwave radio and how I was able to get some news updates about the war in Iraq and things like that with a voice. So what do you consider to be the audience and how do you serve them?
Yes, David, you're right. At one time, everything that we were doing was on shortwave radio. VOA started out in 1942. First language was German. Second language was Japanese to combat the Nazi propaganda that was coming out of Germany, obviously. And the Nazis were using shortwave radio, and you could pick up these propaganda broadcasts in the United States. So since 1942, that's what we've been doing, is broadcasting, especially to countries where there's not a free press or not really a developed press. So including English and learning English, we have 48 language services. VOA is a household name in most of Africa, and I would say in Southeast Asia. We broadcast into North Korea, into China. We use television, satellite TV. We have, in countries that allow us, FM radio affiliates. We have powerful AM broadcast outlets and scattered throughout the world, and social media and online text. However we can reach that audience, we'll do it. And then a branch of our parent agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, will teach people how to use technology, virtual private networks, VPNs, to get around, for example, like the Great Firewall in China, which will block websites like the VOA. So that's essentially what we do. And of course, once in a while, people will think that, this is just America's form of propaganda. But as you alluded to, we have a charter that was passed in the Ford administration, and it says that we must serve as a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news, and that the news will be accurate, objective, and comprehensive, and that we will represent America, not any single segment of American society, that it has to be balanced. So any particular administration that's in office cannot use it just to be the voice of that particular administration. And I like to say, David, we're probably, as a result of that charter, the only news organization in the world that's mandated by law to be fair and objective.
So Donald Trump, though, was critical of Voice of America on several occasions, and he had allegations that it was had an anti-American bias in Voice of America producing content that it favored foreign adversaries and undermined American interest.
There were a couple of instances like that, and you have to look at it in the context of what was going on at the time, that the administration was frustrated that senators from both parties had not brought his nominee forward to run our parent agency, USAGM. And so most objective people looked at this on the outside said there was no problem with VOA's content. It was objective under the charter, as I stated. And people were feeding information to the president about VOA in order to put pressure on the senators by publicizing what the president didn't like about VOA. And one of these instances involved VOA putting online a piece of video from the Associated Press that had come out of China about a city there that was lighting up after 100 days, I think, of being free of COVID or something like that, or the end of lockdown. So there was really nothing of substance to these allegations, but that was sort of the backdrop to this situation, which put us into the limelight in a very uncomfortable way.
So, but also, so this administrator that Trump appointed to the oversee of VOA, that would have been Michael Pack, Trump appointee.
Right.
He took over as CEO of the USA GM in June of 2020. And as soon as he was able to take control of the office, he began what was called a series of firings.
Right. Most of that affected, again, these senior executives of the parent agency. But he had made no secret that he was going to come in there and try to drain the swamp, you know, picking up a phrase that the president had used, who appointed him.
Well, it's a phrase, it's a very charged phrase to use. I mean, he may say that I'm going to drain the swamp, but actually what he did is he got rid of many people who had long careers and had sterling reputations.
Exactly. Yes, and claiming that they, including some of these people that were Republicans, were not loyalists. And so this started a legal process, and a number of people at USAGM and VOA as well, who were being targeted, including myself, became whistleblowers. Lawsuits were filed, and we had very good bipartisan support on Capitol Hill defending the integrity of VOA and opposing these firings at USAGM. And our stance on all of this was generally upheld by judges. Also, there was an inquiry later on by the U.S. Office of Special Counsel, which had received these whistleblower complaints and directed USAGM after the start of the Biden administration to conduct an investigation. And it had its outside experts, and it concluded that what these political appointees had done was wrong, and they actually may have broken the law, and they violated the independence of the journalists. They wrongly retaliated. They engaged, according to this Office of Special Counsel, they engaged in gross management and gross waste by having law firms conduct investigations, and that they broke privacy laws, and on and on and on. So the record seems pretty clear as to what happened, and that it was a political attack, which we, of course, took umbrage because we consider ourselves to be this unbiased, nonpartisan institution. The Trump administration wasn't the first administration to try to chip away at VOA's editorial independence or put pressure on the management of VOA to do certain stories or not do certain stories. But I can tell you, David, as someone who's worked with the VOA in one capacity or another for more than 20 years, no one has ever said to me, you have to do this story or you cannot do this story or that I have to spin it a certain way. If that had been the case, I would have been out of here a long time ago.
Sure, I get that, but I just want to make sure that the listeners understand how serious this was. You know, Michael Pack, fired someone like David Kilgerman. He was a general counsel, and he criticized the other firings, and then he was replaced with a shock jock who had been known for spreading conspiracy theories, calling President Barack Obama a Kenyan. That seemed like there was a really strong attempt to completely change the culture at Voice of America, trying to turn it more into a Trump propaganda machine, amplifier, megaphone for him. And thank goodness that there are those, everything that you mentioned happened, and those safeguards were in place.
Yeah, I go into some of this in the latter chapter of the book, because it was a very important chapter in the history of VOA, and obviously the most overt attempt that VOA and the parent agency ever faced, where I think it was NPR that called it an ideologically driven rampage through a government agency to try to force the newsroom and the workforce to show fealty to the White House.
But there was one time where you became the object of ire from the White House, and they tried to suspend your press pass over your coverage of Pence, Vice President Pence, when he went to the Mayo Clinic?
Yes, I was on that trip. So they didn't try to take away my press pass, although that they attempted that with some other reporters. In my case, I was supposedly kicked off of Air Force Two, not Air Force One, but Air Force Two, because remember, this is during the pandemic, and the vice president's going to the Mayo Clinic to look at, you know, some treatments innovative that are going on there. And a couple days later, after this trip to Minnesota, there was something popped up on.
So he wasn't wearing a mask. He was shown on camera not wearing a mask, walking around the Mayo Clinic.
Correct. And I pointed out, and his wife actually said that he didn't know he was supposed to wear a mask. And then I pointed out that we had been given guidance before the trip that everybody must wear masks. And the vice president's office said that I had broken the rules of confidentiality by revealing the contents of a document that's FPPO, for planning purposes only. And my point was, it was moot because the trip, the planning document, was about a trip that was already over. And so I supposedly was kicked off of future flights of Air Force Two because of that. But in the end, nothing really happened. It was a tempest in a teapot, but that was sort of an example of the
but your objective is to not even be, you don't want to be the news, you want to report the news.
And I want to report the news, not be the news. Correct.
And then right at that time, for people who forgot, you know, that wearing a mask or not wearing a mask became a political statement.
Exactly.
And right. So being able to point out the fact that there was a challenge to Pence's version of events.
Precisely. Now, whether the president or the vice president had been briefed on the memo, the planning document, and I believe that the Mayo Clinic at one point sent out a tweet, which later was deleted, saying that it had also told the vice president's staff that masks were mandatory inside the Mayo Clinic. So, you know, I was there again with, you know, my big boom mic listening in on what Mike Pence was saying, and I actually snapped photos and sent them out immediately on Twitter showing a patient in a COVID patient in the bed who was getting a treatment, and that patient and the medical staff had on masks and Mike Pence did not. I suspect perhaps there's a lot of regret on, about how that was handled by the vice president's staff at the time, because it did not reflect well on them. But as you pointed out, David, this was part of a much larger ideological battle over whether to wear masks or not. And all I was pointing out is we had literally gotten the memo that we were all supposed to wear masks,
right?
And presumably.
So the point I'm getting at, and we're going to talk more about it when we come back from this break, okay, you're an objective reporter, you're reporting the facts, but sometimes those facts run counter to what the White House wanted to be reported on at the time. That brings fire from, you know, supporters of the president. So the question is, can you be objective, be an objective reporter reporting the news when everything becomes politicized? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source will be back right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Stephen Herman. He's the chief national correspondent for Voice of America and the author of the new book, Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist story of covering the president and why it matters. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. And let's go to a caller. We have Jean. And Jean, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. When I'm listening to the journalists in this, and I don't listen to Voice of America that much, but it seems that they play the exact recording of Trump saying something, but they don't play the exact recording of President Biden saying something. I get the impression that Trump is the president.
I don't understand. Tell me more, Jean. What did you mean by that?
Well, instead of quoting Trump as saying he said la-di-da, they play the audio of him saying la-di-da. And when it comes to President Biden, they say, well, he said so-and-so instead of playing the audio.
All right, Jean, thank you for that. So Stephen, that kind of gets to the heart of the accessibility issue and the difference is between these two administrations. I know that that Trump was known for coming down and being and talking a lot to the press. Right. Not so much with Biden. Does that make sense?
Yes. I have little doubt if you were to do a thorough study, and I talk about this in the book, that in some ways, if you're counting the minutes that a president spoke to reporters on the record, that President Trump probably holds the record for the most minutes. We would have what are called pool sprays, which in traditional administrations, you would be in the Oval Office for a maximum of like 60 seconds for a grip and grin, a handshake with a visiting leader for photo purposes. And, you know, a reporter might feebly try to shout a question or two and we'd be quickly ushered out. With Donald Trump, those sessions could go on for a long, long time. I clocked one in, I think it was the cabinet room, that lasted an hour and 10 minutes, where the president was talking on the record or taking questions and answering them from reporters. Joe Biden is much more disciplined in that regard, although he does answer questions off the cuff, and in both the Trump and Biden administrations, sometimes I noticed it was much to the chagrin of the handlers, the press office, because it might break the messaging for that day that they wanted to focus on, or the president inadvertently says something that makes news that becomes quickly criticized. As far as what the caller was referring to, I think she's saying that Biden's being paraphrased more, while Trump, even though he's not president anymore, that the sound bites are being run. And what that's up to each individual network, of course, what they want to run in their newscasts. But if something's provocative, as Donald Trump frequently was as president and as is a presidential candidate, is provocative, and so that makes for a good soundbite.
Also, he's really harder to paraphrase because what he says, I mean, has his own syntax. That's being very nice, nice way to put it.
Right.
The way that
he works
the sentence is odd.
Yeah. When I asked him a question at the World Economic Forum about an environmental issue and Greta Thunberg and all that, you could have come away listening to that quote that he was either a supporter of greater environmental regulation or that he was against it, because he will say things that can be interpreted in different ways or sometimes contradict himself.
Yeah, but he was also kind of more concerned about what an angry person she is.
Say again?
Didn't he comment that she's an angry person?
Oh, yes. Right. The reason I put that in the book is the president would basically go off on a tangent and not answer your question, and it was very, very difficult to pull him back and get him to answer the original question that you were asking. And you know, Donald Trump, there's no doubt he is a very, very effective and savvy communicator, whether or not you like the message, and has had a substantial experience dealing with media and reporters, even though he had never been a politician. And of course, part of his appeal was that he came off as somebody who wasn't a politician and was very undisciplined. And as a reporter covering the White House, where I'm trying to question the president and in real time, this was really something that was very good for us, because if you're a White House correspondent, your job is to have as many opportunities to ask questions of the president and try to get answers.
So in my humble experience, I mean, I've been to the White House and went through that experience myself, and with Ronald Reagan, and they had us shoved into, like, it seemed like a little closet next to the Oval Office, and they flung open the door, and we'd go into the Oval Office, and we're there for almost like 60 seconds, like you said, and then we're shoved back out. So this is not new to Biden or to Obama. This has been the way it's been administration to administration. But when the, you have Trump, you have someone like Kanye West banging on the Resolute desk, things are very different. That's why your experiences are so, compelling. Can you talk about what it was like to be in the Oval Office when Kanye West was there?
That, of all the days that I covered the White House, was probably the most surreal. And it was the only time that I interpreted a look on President Trump's face where he seemed to be projecting that, well, maybe this wasn't the greatest idea, because Kanye West was talking about some, very strange things. I think he was getting into rocket propulsion and was very animated, banging on the Resolute desk, probably the most precious piece of American furniture. The desk can take a pounding, there's no doubt about that. And it was also the first time I'm fairly certain that while reporters were in there on the record, that we heard certain four-letter words uttered. It wasn't by the president, it was by Kanye West. And at one point, Kanye West got up and came around the desk and hugged the president. And so, video cameras are rolling, the photographers are taking their pictures. I'm standing there with a boom mic recording the radio audio for the radio pool. And it was really one of the strangest things. But in a way, it typifies what we saw in the Trump administration, that there would be in the morning some particular messaging that the administration would try to get across about, say, Infrastructure Week was one that happened a lot. But something would happen. The president would say something or do something, or somebody else would do something in the White House that would blow up the messaging. So I frequently, with my editors, usually in the morning, we have conferences, phone conferences, what we're going to cover today, what we expect we're going to report on. And I just got to the point where I'd say, don't ask me in the morning meetings at 3 o'clock. Something will happen that'll be totally unexpected, and we'll be filing on that. And again, my role as a VOA correspondent, first I had this role as a pool reporter going into the Oval Office to get that audio as cleanly as possible, make sure it was broadcast quality and that we captured every word, and try to ask a few questions and feed that as quickly as possible via a cloud service so that every network could have it for its hourly newscasts, and then to do my own reports and try to explain to the rest of the world what was happening and why it was happening and how it was happening.
So when I was coming up in the biz, we were told you never edit the president's comments. You have to take them as they are on tape. And we talked about with Trump and how he will have these really weird dependent clauses and will go off and then he'll come back to finish what he was saying. You can't get a coherent 10-second, 15-second soundbite out of Donald Trump. So did that rule kind of get changed?
Well, I guess in some cases you ran a little bit longer. A lot of networks, perhaps 20 seconds would be a very, very long soundbite. And of course, with the cable networks on TV, they can run a minute of the video uncut.
Still, it's kind of like him talking about how he hates sharks or something for a while, and then he comes back to
right.
Well,
that's where you get in, as the caller was referring to, you know, paraphrasing, where you would try to sum up what the president is saying and then just run a little bit of a clip of that. Of course, what we have seen in recent years for TV cable news channels on different sides of the political spectrum, sort of weaponizing the soundbite, running something over and over again, or editing it in such a way to make it look like the person doesn't
take
know
it
what
out of context.
Talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank goodness we have C-SPAN, right? Where if you want to see the whole thing unedited, uncut, there is a resource out there.
Right. But people need to trust their news agencies to know that they're not going to be underhanded and have bad faith editing on misrepresenting what the president says. And, you know, we can trust Voice of America to do it right. Can we trust other news agencies? You talk about how that's an issue in the book. So we're going to get more on that when we come back from the break. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Behind the White House curtain, a senior journalist story of covering the president and why it matters. Stephen L. Herman is the author, and he joins us. And he's here to take your calls, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I've got a question about being a reporter on the beat covering the White House. I would love to hear your questions and comments. So let's talk about Sean Spicer. He was the communications officer at the White House during the beginning of the Trump years. He, of course, came out during that first press conference, the very first one after Trump's inauguration, proclaiming that it was the biggest crowd ever in the history of inaugurations to witness an inauguration, which, of course, was completely not true. Anyone could see that. But still, that's what they insisted. What did you make of that moment?
Well, obviously, Sean Spicer got off to a really bad start as press secretary for coming out and making that comment. And it's very hard to earn that trust back. Obviously, Spicer was an example of an appointee in the Trump White House who saw that really he was catering to an audience of one. And we could see in some of the briefings with the different press secretaries in the previous administration, notes would be a slip to whoever was at the lectern, because there was someone about 50 feet away in the Oval Office monitoring all this live and trying to feed talking points to the press secretary. So even in the most normal of times, that is a very, very difficult job. It is the last job in Washington that I would want to have, or a lot of other reporters would have. But usually in a lot of administrations, of someone who had been a news reporter was chosen to be the press secretary because they understood the media. They knew what reporters were looking for. And Sean Spicer really did not have that background.
But him coming out there and making this proclamation, ignore the evidence in front of your eyes. We were telling you what reality is. And here again, you are responsible to report on the real reality. How do you rectify, like, this is bonkers? And not only was it just bonkers,
right,
but he was setting a tone from the very first day,
correct,
that the White House was going to tell you what you needed to believe, and if you didn't, then the press is the enemy of the people.
Right. What a good reporter does is you don't take what is being said at face value. You go get quotes from the National Park Service. You have experts who analyze satellite photos look at the photo of the inauguration and can give you a fairly accurate estimate of what the crowd was. And so that's what happened immediately from the start of the Trump administration. There was a lot of fact checking. And some people did not like that in and out of the administration, because I think I can see this from my responses to stories that we would post on social media. There are some people who think your job is to just always criticize the president or the administration, or that your job is just to always agree with them and never criticize them. And what we have, David, of course, is a lot of people these days are not trying to seek out different points of view. It's they're looking, it's called confirmation bias. They're just looking for sources of information that would confirm what they already believe or want to believe. So,
but I hear the criticism of the press. I get it all the time. We just want you to report right. The facts. Just tell us what, you know, the facts. Well, we are reporting the facts, but you just disagree with these facts. And so you're accusing like the hand going through the microphone, or you come up with these elaborate conspiracies to try to explain why you don't need to believe the facts as they have been established by, you know, journalists who are investigating this and have, you know, reality on our side.
Right. I think there's always going to be a little sliver, a little tiny percent of the population that no matter what you put in front of them, no matter what is the reputation of the news organization, that they're just not going to want to believe it. And perhaps there were always people like that out there, but now these people have social media accounts and can create their own programs on TikTok and YouTube.
Right.
And they get an inordinate amount of attention, because if you're, as you're well aware of, if you're, you know, trying to make money off of these things on social media, you need to be get into the favor of the algorithm for that particular platform, and it works to say and do outrageous things. But we need to stress that is not journalism. Mm-hmm. And going on the air and giving your opinion about something is not journalism. Journalism is, as you pointed out, reporting the facts, ideally firsthand, attributing information that you do not witness or get yourself firsthand. And then when you have time to analyze that and put it into context, not to opine about it. And right. I'm very fortunate to work for a government-funded, nonprofit, non-commercial news organization that is not seeking ratings, doesn't have to rely on advertising dollars, and does not have a particular political agenda. But a lot of people that work in the media are under those the types of pressures for ratings and advertising dollars, or working for owners that do have,
or just to elevate agenda. Their byline, they want to become a known brand. You know, they have their own agenda.
Yes, and you were talking about the press briefings with the press secretary, and what happened in the Trump administration, say compared to the Obama administration, where when he was, say, at the end of his presidency, lame duck, those briefings did not get televised, and a lot of the seats were empty. And there was a lot of drilling down on policy nuances. With the Trump administration, those briefings became must-see TV. It was like a daily soap opera carried live on the cable news channels, and sometimes even on, you know, ABC, CBS, and NBC. When there were certain big things happening. So you had reporters also standing up and grandstanding, literally trying to get in a gotcha question or get themselves onto the nightly newscast, where the briefings traditionally had been a much more sleepy affair.
So Sean Spicer, he became like richly parodied on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
It was hilarious. And I mean, what was it like to come to work on Monday morning after there was this hilarious parody of Sean Spicer? Everyone was watching him, tweeting about it, laughing about it, And did he show any signs that this was bothering him?
Oh, he played into it at one point where he quipped, "Don't make me move the podium," after a particular Saturday Night Live episode. I'm sure to some degree, you know, he was getting torn from both sides, right? You had President Trump not being satisfied with his performance, and the reporters sitting in those chairs in the briefing room not satisfied with his performance. And again, the whole sort of atmosphere of those briefings changed because of this intense attention to it. John Decker, who sat next to me at the time in the briefing room, he was Fox News Radio, taught me that you always need, when you're sitting in those briefings, no matter how outrageous the question is from another reporter or what the answer was from the press secretary, not to smirk, not to roll your eyes, because there was also cameras on you sitting in those chairs all the time, and people wanted to
yeah.
And, you know, sometimes that material got used in the newscast too. Right. And, you know, so it was there was a lot of pressure on everybody in that room.
Sean Spicer lasted until July 21st, 2017, and then he was replaced by Anthony Scaramucci, who lasted from July 21st to July 31st. What was that like? I mean, it must have been like, what is going on here? Things seemed very unstable.
Well, I don't know if there's a press secretary who's lasted for an entire 4 years.
More than 10 days.
It did get a little bit ridiculous because, you know, obviously Scaramucci said something in a magazine interview where he thought he was talking off the record, and so he was booted out fairly quickly. He wasn't really the press secretary. He was the communications director, which is another job. So Spicer, officially as press secretary, was followed by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who, of course, is now
the governor
of Arkansas. And she seemed to have a little bit more discipline over the room. And then when she left, we, you know, started to get press secretaries who never gave briefings or rarely gave them, like Stephanie Grisham. And so you had other surrogates in the White House, such as Kellyanne Conway, who would come out to brief the reporters, because while there were no briefings going on, you had people that would just go and do live hits on Fox News. And there were other people in the administration, like Kellyanne, who would come and talk to the reporters who were on the driveway of the West Wing.
It just shows you how out of control things were, how important it is that we have a press corps covering the White House that we can trust, that are honorable, and who are going to do their job, not grandstand, not go out and try and, you know, elevate themselves. And Stephen Herman, thank you so much for writing this book, Behind the White House Curtain, a senior journalist story of covering the president and why it matters. I think that this is something every freshman journalist should read. It's a really good book about how to be a reporter. Appreciate that.
Thank you, David.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.